Definitely, I would love to say that I'm very surprised, but sadly not. And I think especially looking into last year's data and the rise of ransomware attacks around the globe, it's been quite sad to see how the cyber criminal groups are succeeding in this battle, if I may.
And you've got to ask, if cyber criminals can take out a fuel pipeline, what else can they end up taking out? Yes, it's inconvenient for fuel not to get from one place to another, but what about a nuclear power plant, for example, nuclear defenses?
We have recently gathered the cybersecurity leadership community members at the World Economic Forum. 80% of these cyber executives have said that ransomware is becoming such a growing threat that it's actually threatening our public safety. As you say, nuclear power plants, you know, pipelines, telecoms, healthcare providers, as we have seen rise on them. When you think and you try to position yourself in a cyber criminal mind, their goal is to get paid. Where do I target, which might be easiest? For many, many years, financial sector institutions were victims of multiple cyber attacks. As a result, they have matured. Now, when you think about other industries, energy, utility providers, education, healthcare systems, they have not matured yet. And that's why we have seen a rise of cyber attacks like ransomware, like data thefts from these institutions.
So what issues does this pose for businesses everywhere, this latest hack? What can they do to better prepare themselves?
The biggest risk when you think of ransomware attack is business continuity risk. How do you ensure that when a ransomware attack hits, your business processes and operations continue? And that's exactly what's happening in this case. The ransomware attack happened on the corporate network, and as a result, actual operating systems were stopped to ensure that no further operational losses occur. And in this case, actually, it makes me think that we do not have anymore a digital rollback plan. We cannot anymore think of our business processes and procedures in non-digital manner. One thing that we need to ensure that we have prepared as executives, as corporate executives, as board, is tabletop exercises of what we do if none of our digital systems work. How do we ensure we pay our employees? How do we ensure we can invoice our customers? How do we ensure that we can communicate among our teams? How will I call Mike if I don't know Mike's number because it was in my computer or on my phone, which is blocked?
So are you talking about businesses going back to paper?
In emergencies, of course. We are so used to being digital that we cannot anymore foresee being non-digital. We have gathered and worked for the last couple of years with around 50 organizations. And in doing so, in the oil and gas ecosystem, we have observed that companies succeed when they actually elevate cybersecurity to a strategic business challenge. And they still fail when they treat cybersecurity as an IT issue. Definitely, I would love to say that I'm very surprised, but sadly not. And I think especially looking into last year's data and the rise of ransomware attacks around the globe, it's been quite sad to see how the cyber criminal groups are succeeding in this battle, if I may.
And you've got to ask, if cyber criminals can take out a fuel pipeline, what else can they end up taking out? Yes, it's inconvenient for fuel not to get from one place to another, but what about a nuclear power plant, for example, nuclear defenses?
We have recently gathered the cybersecurity leadership community members at the World Economic Forum. 80% of these cyber executives have said that ransomware is becoming such a growing threat that is actually threatening our public safety. As you say, nuclear power plants, you know, pipelines, telecoms, healthcare providers, as we have seen rise on them. When you think and you try to position yourself in a cyber criminal mind, their goal is to get paid. Where do I target, which might be easiest? For many, many years, financial sector institutions were victims of multiple cyber attacks. As a result, they have matured. Now, when you think about other industries, energy, utility providers, education, healthcare systems, they have not matured yet. And that's why we have seen a rise of cyber attacks like ransomware, like data thefts from these institutions.
So what issues does this pose for businesses everywhere, this latest hack? What can they do to better prepare themselves?
The biggest risk when you think of ransomware attack is business continuity risk. How do you ensure that when a ransomware attack hits, your business processes and operations continue? And that's exactly what's happening in this case. The ransomware attack happened on the corporate network, and as a result, actual operating systems were stopped to ensure that no further operational losses occur. And in this case, actually, it makes me think that we do not have anymore a digital rollback plan. We cannot anymore think of our business processes and procedures in non-digital manner. One thing that we need to ensure that we have prepared as executives, as corporate executives, as board, is tabletop exercises of what we do if none of our digital systems work. How do we ensure we pay our employees? How do we ensure we can invoice our customers? How do we ensure that we can communicate among our teams? How will I call Mike if I don't know Mike's number because it was in my computer or on my phone, which is blocked?
So are you talking about businesses going back to paper?
In emergencies, of course. We are so used to being digital that we cannot anymore foresee being non-digital. We have gathered and worked for the last couple of years with around 50 organizations. And in doing so, in the oil and gas ecosystem, we have observed that companies succeed when they actually elevate cybersecurity to a strategic business challenge. And they still fail when they treat cybersecurity as an IT issue. Definitely, I would love to say that I'm very surprised, but sadly not. And I think especially looking into last year's data and the rise of ransomware attacks around the globe, it's been quite sad to see how the cyber criminal groups are succeeding in this battle, if I may.
And you've got to ask, if cyber criminals can take out a fuel pipeline, what else can they end up taking out? Yes, it's inconvenient for fuel not to get from one place to another, but what about a nuclear power plant, for example, nuclear defenses?
We have recently gathered the cybersecurity leadership community members at the World Economic Forum. 80% of these cyber executives have said that ransomware is becoming such a growing threat that it's actually threatening our public safety. As you say, nuclear power plants, you know, pipelines, telecoms, healthcare providers, as we have seen rise on them. When you think and you try to position yourself in a cyber criminal mind, their goal is to get paid. Where do I target, which might be easiest? For many, many years, financial sector institutions were victims of multiple cyber attacks. As a result, they have matured. Now, when you think about other industries, energy, utility providers, education, healthcare systems, they have not matured yet. And that's why we have seen a rise of cyber attacks like ransomware, like data thefts from these institutions.
So what issues does this pose for businesses everywhere, this latest hack? What can they do to better prepare themselves?
The biggest risk when you think of ransomware attack is business continuity risk. How do you ensure that when a ransomware attack hits, your business processes and operations continue? And that's exactly what's happening in this case. The ransomware attack happened on the corporate network, and as a result, actual operating systems were stopped to ensure that no further operational losses occur. And in this case, actually, it makes me think that we do not have anymore a digital rollback plan. We cannot anymore think of our business processes and procedures in non-digital manner. One thing that we need to ensure that we have prepared as executives, as corporate executives, as board, is tabletop exercises of what we do if none of our digital systems work. How do we ensure we pay our employees? How do we ensure we can invoice our customers? How do we ensure that we can communicate among our teams? How will I call Mike if I don't know Mike's number because it was in my computer or on my phone, which is blocked?
So are you talking about businesses going back to paper?
In emergencies, of course. We are so used to being digital that we cannot anymore foresee being non-digital. We have gathered and worked for the last couple of years with around 50 organizations. And in doing so, in the oil and gas ecosystem, we have observed that companies succeed when they actually elevate cybersecurity to a strategic business challenge. And they still fail when they treat cybersecurity as an IT issue.
In the 1930s, American industrialist Henry Ford had one overwhelming obsession: soybeans. He extracted their oil to make enamel for painting his cars. He crushed them into powder to make plastic parts. And he encouraged American farmers to grow as much of the plant as possible. But he wasn't just feeding soy to machines. At the Chicago World's Fair, he hosted a soy-centric feast. The ingredient had been a staple in Asian cuisine for centuries, but Ford's dinner, full of soy substitutes for dairy, meat, and wheat, took the integration of soy into food a step further. Today, soy is in so many foods that most people consume it every day without even knowing it. So what makes soybeans so versatile? And is our global obsession healthy or harmful? Soybeans have been cultivated in Asia as early as 5,500 years ago, But since then, they've spread across the globe. Part of soy's success is that the crop can be grown easily and cheaply in variable conditions. And once they're grown, soybeans have an incredibly high density of proteins and fats, ingredients which in recent years have been used in everything from mayonnaise to biodegradable plastic. The ideal method for separating these components depends on what you're trying to extract. To isolate soy proteins, dehulled beans are sometimes pressed through rollers to create thin flakes, and then steeped in water to draw out the proteins. Alternatively, whole beans can be simply soaked and ground into a whitish protein-rich liquid. In both cases, the resulting substance can be used to make spongy foods like tofu, or filtered to produce soy milk. And at the industrial scale, these proteins can be used in various ways to help make processed foods. Soy fats may be even more versatile. In one extraction method, soybeans are dried, cleaned, and then fed into an extruder. This machine simultaneously heats and presses the beans, producing a liquid containing soy oil and other fatty components. By adding water and spinning the mixture, components are separated into two parts: refined soy oil for things like salad dressing, and a substance called lecithin. Lecithin is made of molecules called phospholipids, which have a phosphate head that attracts water and a tail that attracts fat. These features make phospholipids excellent for blending ingredients that naturally separate from each other. This process is called emulsification, and soy lecithins are used as emulsifying agent in a huge variety of foods. For example, during chocolate production, phospholipids attach to both the fatty components of the cocoa butter and the water-soluble sugar particles, making them easier to combine into a smooth mixture. A similar process happens in powdered products that need to be instantly rehydrated. Soy lecithin bonds with the water and helps the powder disperse more quickly. While there are other plants we can process for lecithin and proteins, soy's mild taste and widespread availability have earned it a place in thousands of food products. But is it unhealthy to be eating this much soy? Not really. Soybeans contain many of the essential amino acids our bodies need, making them one of the best ways to get these proteins without eating meat. And the bean's fat content is largely made up of so-called good fats, poly and monounsaturated fatty acids, which can decrease cholesterol and reduce the risk of heart disease. There are some compounds in soy that may inhibit our body's absorption of various minerals. And about 0.3% of the general population has a soy allergy, which can be severe in rare cases. But for many people, the biggest complaint about soy consumption is the occasional increase in flatulence. Outside our bodies, however, soy is much more worrying. To accommodate the soy farms needed for heavy industry, processed foods, and livestock feed, huge swaths of land have been deforested. Between 2006 and 2017, roughly 22,000 square kilometers of the Amazon were cleared for soy production. In some regions, this has also led to the displacement of farmers and indigenous communities. So if we want to keep using soy and all its byproducts, we'll need to find a way to do it humanely and sustainably. Achieving sustainability is a complex problem, and it's hard to solve a problem if it isn't understood. That's why we've created Earth School, a library of videos and resources covering everything from upgrading transport to the future of food. Check it out at ed.ted.com/earthschool. In the 1930s, American industrialist Henry Ford had one overwhelming obsession: soybeans. He extracted their oil to make enamel for painting his cars. He crushed them into powder to make plastic parts. And he encouraged American farmers to grow as much of the plant as possible. But he wasn't just feeding soy to machines. At the Chicago World's Fair, he hosted a soy-centric feast. The ingredient had been a staple in Asian cuisine for centuries, but Ford's dinner, full of soy substitutes for dairy, meat, and wheat, took the integration of soy into food a step further. Today, soy is in so many foods that most people consume it every day without even knowing it. So what makes soybeans so versatile? And is our global obsession healthy or harmful? Soybeans have been cultivated in Asia as early as 5,500 years ago. But since then, they've spread across the globe. Part of soy's success is that the crop can be grown easily and cheaply in variable conditions. And once they're grown, soybeans have an incredibly high density of proteins and fats, ingredients which in recent years have been used in everything from mayonnaise to biodegradable plastic. The ideal method for separating these components depends on what you're trying to extract. To isolate soy proteins, dehulled beans are sometimes pressed through rollers to create thin flakes, and then steeped in water to draw out the proteins. Alternatively, whole beans can be simply soaked and ground into a whitish protein-rich liquid. In both cases, the resulting substance can be used to make spongy foods like tofu, or filtered to produce soy milk. And at the industrial scale, these proteins can be used in various ways to help make processed foods. Soy fats may be even more versatile. In one extraction method, soybeans are dried, cleaned, and then fed into an extruder. This machine simultaneously heats and presses the beans, producing a liquid containing soy oil and other fatty components. By adding water and spinning the mixture, components are separated into two parts: refined soy oil for things like salad dressing, and a substance called lecithin. Lecithin is made of molecules called phospholipids, which have a phosphate head that attracts water and a tail that attracts fats. These features make phospholipids excellent for blending ingredients that naturally separate from each other. This process is called emulsification, and soy lecithins are used as emulsifying agent in a huge variety of foods. For example, during chocolate production, phospholipids attach to both the fatty components of the cocoa butter and the water-soluble sugar particles, making them easier to combine into a smooth mixture. A similar process happens in powdered products that need to be instantly rehydrated. Soy lecithin bonds with the water and helps the powder disperse more quickly. While there are other plants we can process for lecithin and proteins, soy's mild taste and widespread availability have earned it a place in thousands of food products. But is it unhealthy to be eating this much soy? Not really. Soybeans contain many of the essential amino acids our bodies need, making them one of the best ways to get these proteins without eating meat. And the bean's fat content is largely made up of so-called good fats, poly and monounsaturated fatty acids, which can decrease cholesterol and reduce the risk of heart disease. There are some compounds in soy that may inhibit our body's absorption of various minerals. And about 0.3% of the general population has a soy allergy, which can be severe in rare cases. But for many people, the biggest complaint about soy consumption is the occasional increase in flatulence. Outside our bodies, however, soy is much more worrying. To accommodate the soy farms needed for heavy industry, processed foods, and livestock feed, huge swaths of land have been deforested. Between 2006 and 2017, roughly 22,000 square kilometers of the Amazon were cleared for soy production. In some regions, this has also led to the displacement of farmers and indigenous communities. So if we want to keep using soy and all its byproducts, we'll need to find a way to do it humanely and sustainably. Achieving sustainability is a complex problem, and it's hard to solve a problem if it isn't understood. That's why we've created Earth School, a library of videos and resources covering everything from upgrading transport to the future of food. Check it out at ed.ted.com/earthschool. In the 1930s, American industrialist Henry Ford had one overwhelming obsession: soybeans. He extracted their oil to make enamel for painting his cars. He crushed them into powder to make plastic parts. And he encouraged American farmers to grow as much of the plant as possible. But he wasn't just feeding soy to machines. At the Chicago World's Fair, he hosted a soy-centric feast. The ingredient had been a staple in Asian cuisine for centuries, but Ford's dinner, full of soy substitutes for dairy, meat, and wheat, took the integration of soy into food a step further. Today, soy is in so many foods that most people consume it every day without even knowing it. So what makes soybeans so versatile? And is our global obsession healthy or harmful? Soybeans have been cultivated in Asia as early as 5,500 years ago. But since then, they've spread across the globe. Part of soy's success is that the crop can be grown easily and cheaply in variable conditions. And once they're grown, soybeans have an incredibly high density of proteins and fats, ingredients which in recent years have been used in everything from mayonnaise to biodegradable plastic. The ideal method for separating these components depends on what you're trying to extract. To isolate soy proteins, dehulled beans are sometimes pressed through rollers to create thin flakes, and then steeped in water to draw out the proteins. Alternatively, whole beans can be simply soaked and ground into a whitish protein-rich liquid. In both cases, the resulting substance can be used to make spongy foods like tofu, or filtered to produce soy milk. And at the industrial scale, these proteins can be used in various ways to help make processed foods. Soy fats may be even more versatile. In one extraction method, soybeans are dried, cleaned, and then fed into an extruder. This machine simultaneously heats and presses the beans, producing a liquid containing soy oil and other fatty components. By adding water and spinning the mixture, components are separated into two parts: refined soy oil for things like salad dressing, and a substance called lecithin. Lecithin is made of molecules called phospholipids, which have a phosphate head that attracts water and a tail that attracts fats. These features make phospholipids excellent for blending ingredients that naturally separate from each other. This process is called emulsification, and soy lecithins are used as emulsifying agent in a huge variety of foods. For example, during chocolate production, phospholipids attach to both the fatty components of the cocoa butter and the water-soluble sugar particles, making them easier to combine into a smooth mixture. A similar process happens in powdered products that need to be instantly rehydrated. Soy lecithin bonds with the water and helps the powder disperse more quickly. While there are other plants we can process for lecithin and proteins, soy's mild taste and widespread availability have earned it a place in thousands of food products. But is it unhealthy to be eating this much soy? Not really. Soybeans contain many of the essential amino acids our bodies need, making them one of the best ways to get these proteins without eating meat. And the bean's fat content is largely made up of so-called good fats, poly and monounsaturated fatty acids, which can decrease cholesterol and reduce the risk of heart disease. There are some compounds in soy that may inhibit our body's absorption of various minerals. And about 0.3% of the general population has a soy allergy, which can be severe in rare cases. But for many people, the biggest complaint about soy consumption is the occasional increase in flatulence. Outside our bodies, however, soy is much more worrying. To accommodate the soy farms needed for heavy industry, processed foods, and livestock feed, huge swaths of land have been deforested. Between 2006 and 2017, roughly 22,000 square kilometers of the Amazon were cleared for soy production. In some regions, this has also led to the displacement of farmers and indigenous communities. So if we want to keep using soy and all its byproducts, we'll need to find a way to do it humanely and sustainably. Achieving sustainability is a complex problem, and it's hard to solve a problem if it isn't understood. That's why we've created Earth School, a library of videos and resources covering everything from upgrading transport to the future of food. Check it out at ed.ted.com/earthschool.
is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Shayla Farzan. Climate change is affecting animals in a lot of different ways, but scientists have noticed a common trend across a variety of species. They're getting smaller, as in physically smaller in size. But why, and what could this mean? Scientists have observed this phenomenon in very different animal species, from wild sheep to wood rats. But it's especially well documented in North American songbirds. In 2019, researchers at the University of Michigan published a data set of more than 70,000 birds that died after hitting windows in Chicago. The data showed that the body sizes for dozens of species had actually shrunk over the past 40 years. But when Justin Baldwin, a graduate student at Washington University in St. Louis, took a closer look at the data, something stood out.
There clearly seemed to be some species that were shrinking a lot and other species that were shrinking much less.
The question was, why were some bird species shrinking faster than others? Baldwin and his colleagues had a feeling that bird behavior might be playing a role. In birds, species with bigger brains tend to be smarter and can change their behavior based on their environment. That means they might be able to buffer themselves from increasing temperatures, says Carlos Botero, an assistant professor of biology at Washington University and the study's co-author.
By adjusting their behavior, by changing the places that they look for food, the times of the day in which they do that, the things that they eat, and the ways in which they access those food sources, all those are ways in which they could experience a little bit less of a negative selection from all this variety of changes that we're seeing through climate change.
A bigger-brained bird, for example, might adjust its behavior and stay in the shadows when it's hot. So the team decided to reanalyze that massive original data set, but this time factor in brain size. They found birds with larger brains in relation to their body size are shrinking at slower rates than birds with smaller brains. And that was true even after controlling for other factors that could affect how quickly these birds are evolving, like generation time and mutation rate. But Botero says, just because these larger-brained bird species can temporarily buffer themselves from warmer temperatures, it doesn't mean they're completely protected from climate change.
It is important to realize that what we see here is not an indication that big-brained birds are fine and that they are not having any problems or that they are just capable to take whatever kind of change is coming from this suite of different environmental phenomena that is happening right now.
Still, the team says there's a lot left to learn when it comes to the ways in which behavior could affect how bird species respond to climate change. For one thing, in this study, there was only about a twofold difference in relative brain size between the species with the largest brain, the song sparrow, and the one with the smallest, the Swainson's thrush. That means the responses could be even stronger in birds with larger brains, like crows.
We're sampling only a small amount of the potential variation in relative brain size here in our study. And so that does suggest that even potentially small differences in relative brain size might actually have a large effect on ecological responses to climate change.
For now, Baldwin says, one of the key takeaways is that smaller brain bird species could be especially vulnerable as the climate continues to change. For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Shayla Farzan. This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Shayla Farzan. Climate change is affecting animals in a lot of different ways, but scientists have noticed a common trend across a variety of species. They're getting smaller, as in physically smaller in size. But why, and what could this mean? Scientists have observed this phenomenon in very different animal species, from wild sheep to wood rats. But it's especially well documented in North American songbirds. In 2019, researchers at the University of Michigan published a data set of more than 70,000 birds that died after hitting windows in Chicago. The data showed that the body sizes for dozens of species had actually shrunk over the past 40 years. But when Justin Baldwin, a graduate student at Washington University in St. Louis, took a closer look at the data, something stood out.
There clearly seemed to be some species that were shrinking a lot and other species that were shrinking much less.
The question was, why were some bird species shrinking faster than others? Baldwin and his colleagues had a feeling that bird behavior might be playing a role. In birds, species with bigger brains tend to be smarter and can change their behavior based on their environment. That means they might be able to buffer themselves from increasing temperatures, says Carlos Botero, an assistant professor of biology at Washington University and the study's co-author.
By adjusting their behavior, by changing the places that they look for food, the times of the day in which they do that, the things that they eat, and the ways in which they access those food sources, all those are ways in which they could experience a little bit less of a negative selection from all this variety of changes that we're seeing through climate change.
A bigger-brained bird, for example, might adjust its behavior and stay in the shadows when it's hot. So the team decided to reanalyze that massive original data set, but this time factor in brain size. They found birds with larger brains in relation to their body size are shrinking at slower rates than birds with smaller brains. And that was true even after controlling for other factors that could affect how quickly these birds are evolving, like generation time and mutation rate. But Botero says, just because these larger-brained bird species can temporarily buffer themselves from warmer temperatures, it doesn't mean they're completely protected from climate change.
It is important to realize that what we see here is not an indication that big-brained birds are fine and that they are not having any problems or that they are just capable to take whatever kind of change is coming from this suite of different environmental phenomena that is happening right now.
Still, the team says there's a lot left to learn when it comes to the ways in which behavior could affect how bird species respond to climate change. For one thing, in this study, there was only about a twofold difference in relative brain size between the species with the largest brain, the song sparrow, and the one with the smallest, the Swainson's thrush. That means the responses could be even stronger in birds with larger brains, like crows.
We're sampling only a small amount of the potential variation in relative brain size here in our study. And so that does suggest that even potentially small differences in relative brain size might actually have a large effect on ecological responses to climate change.
For now, Baldwin says, one of the key takeaways is that smaller brain bird species could be especially vulnerable as the climate continues to change. For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Shayla Farzon. This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Shayla Farzon. Climate change is affecting animals in a lot of different ways, but scientists have noticed a common trend across a variety of species. They're getting smaller, as in physically smaller in size. But why, and what could this mean? Scientists have observed this phenomenon in very different animal species, from wild sheep to wood rats. But it's especially well-documented in North American songbirds. In 2019, researchers at the University of Michigan published a data set of more than 70,000 birds that died after hitting windows in Chicago. The data showed that the body sizes for dozens of species had actually shrunk over the past 40 years. But when Justin Baldwin, a graduate student at Washington University in St. Louis, took a closer look at the data, something stood out.
There clearly seemed to be some species that were shrinking a lot and other species that were shrinking much less.
The question was, why were some bird species shrinking faster than others? Baldwin and his colleagues had a feeling that bird behavior might be playing a role. In birds, species with bigger brains tend to be smarter and can change their behavior based on their environment. That means they might be able to buffer themselves from increasing temperatures, says Carlos Botero, an assistant professor of biology at Washington University and the study's co-author.
By adjusting their behavior, by changing the places that they look for food, the times of the day in which they do that, the things that they eat, and the ways in which they access those food sources, all of those are ways in which they could experience a little bit less of a negative selection from all this variety of changes that we're seeing through climate change.
A bigger-brained bird, for example, might adjust its behavior and stay in the shadows when it's hot. So the team decided to reanalyze that massive original data set, but this time factor in brain size. They found birds with larger brains in relation to their body size are shrinking at slower rates than birds with smaller brains. And that was true even after controlling for other factors that could affect how quickly these birds are evolving, like generation time and mutation rate. But Botero says, just because these larger-brained bird species can temporarily buffer themselves from warmer temperatures, it doesn't mean they're completely protected from climate change.
It is important to realize that what we see here is not an indication that big-brained birds are fine and that they are not having any problems or that they are just capable to take whatever kind of change is coming from this suite of different environmental phenomena that is happening right now.
Still, the team says there's a lot left to learn when it comes to the ways in which behavior could affect how bird species respond to climate change. For one thing, in this study, there was only about a twofold difference in relative brain size between the species with the largest brain, the song sparrow, and the one with the smallest, the Swainson's thrush. That means the responses could be even stronger in birds with larger brains, like crows.
We're sampling only a small amount of the potential variation in relative brain size here in our study. And so that does suggest that even potentially small differences in relative brain size might actually have a large effect on ecological responses to climate change.
For now, Baldwin says, one of the key takeaways is that smaller brain bird species could be especially vulnerable as the climate continues to change. For Scientific American 60 Second Science, I'm Shayla Farzon.